Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
Good morning, John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, this may come as a news bulletin for you. There are just as many college students dropping out of college these days as are enrolling. And the United States is now lagging behind our counterparts in the developed world in college graduation rates. We're going to talk about strategies to help college students graduate this hour on the Ideas Network, and we welcome your thoughts on this topic at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, talk at WPR.org, or you can find the Joy Cardine program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. In particular, I'd like to hear from you if you're somebody who started college but was unable for one reason or another to finish, or if you struggled to finish in even 6 years and why that might have been. That would be very valuable for us this hour, 800-642-1234. My guest is Cliff Conrad, Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor and Professor of Higher Education and WISCAPE Affiliate in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. Professor Conrad, welcome and good morning.
Good morning, John.
So this was something of a surprise when I saw these statistics that we just aren't graduating. A lot of people who enter college, and now the dropout rate is equal to the enrollment rate.
I'm not quite as surprised, pardon me, as you are. It's not wholly unexpected. We've made an enormous investment in higher education over the last 40 years, as you know, in the federal government, Pell Grants and so on in 1972. I think there are two reasons why the dropout rate is as challenging as it is. And one is simply that the resources have diminished for higher education over the last few years. In particular, the state decline in public funding for higher education is defined very markedly. Some states, like Michigan, it's down to single digits. It really is, including in Wisconsin, that's down very markedly. But I think the real challenge is enrollment has skyrocketed over the last 40 years, and the students who are coming are much more diverse. And that diversity, I think, is sometimes overlooked. Not only are many of these students low-income students, but we have students from races and ethnicities who have not been to higher education historically in great numbers, many first-generation students. And along with that, I'd like to accent many of these students are coming with very formidable challenges. They aren't as prepared academically, not just in reading and mathematics and writing, but other subjects as well. Limited, sometimes it's second language students. Many students, as we know, English is a second language. Many of them are part-time working. They're taking care of a family and sometimes lacking basic college-going skills, like showing up for college in a timely way and so on, just kind of basic skills. I haven't had the opportunities to acquire all those skills. So I think for those two reasons, insufficient resources and a wide range of students with a lot of challenges facing them, that it's not altogether surprising that the dropout rate is as high as it is. No, and we're trying to accomplish a great deal in the United States, getting so many people into college. I think there's something like 27 million students today. That's a lot of students. But a lot of those students have formidable challenges.
Well, there's no question that the cost of a college education has exploded, and I don't think that's hyperbole at all. over the last 20 years. College tuition rates have steadily climbed. It just costs a lot more. Housing, everything costs a lot more these days. Students have to work multiple jobs in order to even stay in school, and that probably affects their experience of college. I mean, I guess, you know, for those of us who went to a university in the late 60s, maybe the early 70s, finished in 4 years, maybe worked a part-time work-study job, if at all, during the school year, that's quite a bit a different experience than what most college students have today.
It's an unbelievably different experience. I happened to go to college at roughly the same time and had a lot of privilege and opportunities. And, yeah, the resources are challenging. But along with that, again, the other challenges, including language, not being as prepared sometimes academically, not even having a good sense of what college is. And taking care of family, I've visited with students all over the United States, first-generation students who talk in very oftentimes dramatic terms about the challenges they face at home and trying to take care of their home life and children sometimes. They may have two or three children or siblings that are relatively young, perhaps a mother or grandmother at the same time. And so it's not only the finances. I think that we sometimes define the problem as one as limited finances and even working. It's much often much more than that as well.
Well, and there's we tend to look at college students differently than we do those in the K-12 education system. So until maybe the problem is that when you're 18, you reach the age of majority, and it just seems like if students fail in K-12, it's the school's fault and the teacher's fault. If they fail in college, we make that the fault of the student.
We do. We play the blame game way too much. And I think what we haven't done, pardon me, is take an introspective look at ourselves and what we can be doing in the higher learning. It's something I've been studying the last 3 years in particular. What can we do differently to better take care of, ensure that these students are not only matriculating and getting access to college, but also learning and ultimately graduating?
Here's a Facebook comment that I think points out maybe a frustration that a lot of students have, and it's probably one that you've heard before as well. Terry writes on Facebook, "Stop requiring so many courses that do not apply to the degree a person is trying to achieve. I know in my experience, there was 2.5 years of required science, mathematics, and foreign language before I could even start taking courses in my chosen field, English. Is there a difference between forcing someone to become a, quote, well-rounded individual, end quote, and making them pay for it with money and time?"
Well, I think I would say to Terry that I've studied undergraduate education for several decades and written a book with Laura Dunick called Cultivating Inquiry-Driven Learners, a College Education for the 21st Century. I believe very strongly that we need a kind of a foundation. And many of those basic courses that we get, sometimes they're called the liberal arts and sciences, sometimes called general education, provide the foundation for people to have the basic kind of capabilities, the higher order thinking skills, the capacity to communicate and express their thinking and ideas. Those are fundamental whatever profession you're in, as well as in the rest of your life. So I think that we don't want to look quite so skeptically on providing a basic education, and not least for English majors, who I think can benefit enormously from having more what has been historically called a general education.
Mm-hmm. 800-642-1234, the number to call. We're talking about higher education this hour. There are now just as many college students dropping out of college as there are enrolling, and the U.S. is lagging behind its counterparts in the developed world in graduation rates. We're talking about why that's the case and wondering what you think. What was your college experience like? Did you get the care and attention you needed, or did you feel like a number? And that's something we'll talk about after the break. Was it a struggle to graduate, or maybe you didn't have a real tough time? I'd like to hear about that and how you did it, what your experience of college was like. as well. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can find us on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Why is it so difficult these days to get a college degree? As many people dropping out of college as enrolling, we're talking about why that is this hour on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. My guest, Cliff Conrad, Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Higher Education in the Department of Education Leadership and Policy Analysis at the UW-Madison. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join our program. And let's take a call from Bill in Sun Prairie. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Very good program. I'd like to make a few fast points. Number one, I think a lot more attention should be paid to neuroscience. My understanding is that the male brain really doesn't fully develop until age 25, so a lot of kids entering college are really not ready. The other thing that seems to not have enough attention is Howard Gardner's multiple intelligence. There is many different types of intelligence, and not all of them are suited for academia. I think we should learn from the German model of apprenticeships. Another point is I entered engineering school back in 1960 on a work-study program. I went to school for 3 months, and then I worked for 3 months, and I ended up with no college debt. I understand that isn't practical for a lot of curriculums, but I think it's relevant to the discussion. The last thing is that it seems to me the overhead in universities have gotten tremendous, and their tuitions are so costly. I think there should be better models and less expensive ways to get an education, perhaps a combination of universities and online. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Bill, thanks for a call. Well, Professor, a lot to chew on there.
Yeah, there's 4 points. I appreciate them all. I don't think I'm the neuroscience points is sort of an interesting one. And the tuition one, a lot of people, I agree 100% with that. Tuition has gotten so high now. It's such a formidable challenge for so many people that many students simply have to work. I do think that having experiences, including Bill mentioned apprenticeship, are very, very critical, and they can involve all sorts of opportunities. I should mention here, though, that I've interviewed students across the country over the last 3 years in a major study of minority-serving colleges and universities, and in so doing, we've learned a great deal. My colleague Mary Beth Gassman at the University of Pennsylvania and I, in studying these institutions, about ways to facilitate what we call student success, and including learning and persistence, and we've taken a lot of lessons from those, and those certainly, one of those lessons does have to do with apprenticeship. When you go to a tribal college in Montana, for example, Felice Kootenai College up in northwest Montana, and you hear from students who have not, some students, one who hadn't done traditionally very well in college, but all of a sudden got excited about STEM disciplines and the sciences, and in engineering in particular, and ended up going to the Johnson Space Center for an apprenticeship. It changed the young man's life. So those kind of experiences, what might be called non-traditional experiences, can be very powerful for students of regardless of where they're coming from. And I could give many other examples as well.
Well, one of the things that Bill pointed out and that you brought up is there are a lot more, there are a lot of students going to college these days who probably aren't ready to be there for whatever reason, whether it's neuroscience or they really, maybe the college environment isn't suited for them, and maybe they need to go work a couple of years before they go back to school because they'd be more motivated for whatever reason is part of the problem, again, that we're sending students to school. We're encouraging a lot of people to go to college who maybe should be somewhere else.
No, I think that's kind of a deficit view. I take an asset view, namely that I think that what the challenge, the overarching challenge is simply this, that we are not appreciating, I began by talking about the diversity of students. And they're capable, but they have challenges that we haven't begun to address. Let me be a little more specific. They ask questions in interviewing students at tribal colleges, historically black colleges, Hispanic-serving institutions, over the last 3 years. They're not sure what college is. Why am I here? How do I navigate college? Am I good enough? How do I get ready? Many of them have extraordinary amounts of fear, even though they're very, very capable, talking to students who have, for example, math shame and so on. It isn't that they aren't able. It's that their challenges like fear, and we haven't begun to address them. It isn't enough to talk just very sweepingly about more funding for cutting tuition down and so on, and simply an apprenticeship. It's some other things, and what we've written a book that will be coming out this year, Lessons from the Margins, What American Higher Ed Can Learn From Historically from Minority-Serving Colleges and Universities, are lessons that I think many people at most of our institutions, including predominantly white institutions, are oblivious to, and I could mention some of those lessons, a couple of them, if you'd like.
Well, sure, go ahead.
One of them is simply what I use the term asset-based. There's nothing for a kid who's 18 or 23, got a family, doesn't have a lot of money, fearful about college. The first and foremost thing you can do, I won't use the word hope, but it may sound a little bit corny, but you believe those students can succeed and that you expect them to succeed. We need to uplift students, not just knock them down. And I can't begin to tell you what it's like going to a historically black college, for example, or a tribal college, where, as I mentioned, Salish Kootenai College up in Montana, tribal college, what faculty do and staff, they give students validation, a sense of value, a sense of, you can do it, now just do it. And then they give them support along with it. It's very, very uplifting. Another lesson I'll just mention briefly is we have very siloed roles in academia, most colleges, universities. What I mean by that is that administrators, faculty teach, staff assist students, and students learn, right? And what many institutions, minority-serving institutions, are blurring roles. Everybody is engaged in teaching and learning, and it's quite astonishing, as somebody who studied colleges and universities for about four decades, to go to places where you see that faculty and students, everybody is teaching and learning from one another. You go to a Department of Academic Success, a little unit at Salish Kootenai College, for example, you see staff teaching as much and other students working with students who've got challenges in math and English and so on. So those are just two examples I can mention, some other ones too.
Well, the phone lines are pretty full. I'd like to get some of these callers on before we have to go to the news here in just a couple of minutes. Brian in La Crosse, you'll be next. Brian, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Morning, Brian. Go ahead.
It's interesting, kind of some of the creative things your guest comes up with here about uplifting students, and if you believe in them, it'll take care of itself. You know, the reason students are dropping out in droves isn't because of diversity or language or any of these other creative things. It's because most kids don't need to be going to college, and we're steering a lot of people there that shouldn't be there, and it's doing them a great disservice. The reason we have bad schools is the same reason as why we have bad public high schools. It's not because we have bad teachers. It's not because they're not funded well. It's because we have bad students. And there's just no creative way or nice way around that. What the caller said before about the German model is probably right. We need to really rethink the entire model.
All right, Brian, we're kind of losing you there. So thanks for the call, Professor.
Oh, well, obviously I respectfully disagree with Brian. I think I've seen so many instances, stories, and we've written about many of them in the book, of students who wouldn't expect to succeed in college, who, for example, become STEM students, STEM scholars, students at the College of Menominee in the state of Wisconsin, for example, and a STEM scholars and STEM leaders program weren't necessarily always great students. beginning college, but they have people believe in them. And let's get the other half of that, Brian. Not only do they believe in them, they expect them to succeed. And they and those two are coupled together tightly. It's not just hope and believe in. So I've seen way too many stories of students who've crossed the border from Juarez, Texas, over to El Paso, go to El Paso Community College, begin with reading levels, English as a second language, and all of a sudden their life is being transformed by a teacher or an advisor who believes in them and then expects them and works with them very, very hard to develop those college-going skills, help them to understand what college is, and then along with faculty and other students, works with them often collaboratively to enhance their critical thinking skills and capacities that will enable them to be highly successful in college. So I respectfully disagree on that point.
Brian, thanks so much for the call. Plenty of room for you to get in. We'll be taking more calls after the news at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We're just about at news time, so I don't want to start a new topic now. But, Professor, one of the things I want to follow up on, something you just were talking about, is the importance of how much actual individual care and attention students get at a college or a university. And in some of the articles I read in preparation for the show, there were discussions of what are called dropout factories, where students don't get much from the schools they're attending in terms of the kind of support that they need, tutoring, individual attention, and solid advisement, which is so crucial to student success. I'd like to talk about that a little bit more after we take a break for the news. Wondering what you think, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or find the Joy Carding Program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. We'll continue our discussion about higher ed and the dropout rate after this news. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. Well, there are just as many college students dropping out of college as are enrolling. And the United States is lagging behind its counterparts in the developed world in college graduation rates. We're talking about why that's the case and what might be done about it this morning with Cliff Conrad, Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Higher Education in the Department of Education, Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. Well, Professor, before the break, you touched on this when you were describing places where students had success. You talked a lot about mentoring and tutoring and individual attention that students get. That really is kind of the crux of taking students who, you know, they come right out of high school. In some cases, they've never lived away from home. They're in a foreign environment. They face a lot of challenges financially and otherwise. That really can make the difference between success and failure is how much attention a student actually gets.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely critical one-on-one. I think sometimes we use concepts like advising rather vaguely. I would emphasize here that in studying, I mentioned minority-serving colleges, universities, that it's been very interesting for me and my colleague, including Dr. Todd Lundberg, who I work with here, to observe the kind of range of ways in which institutions are paying attention to students. Let me give you a couple examples. One is, and often what they're doing, by the way, is providing guides to help students. A lot of it is just navigating college, helping them to understand what college is, how to capitalize on the resources available, and so on. But let me give an example from a Hispanic-serving institutions, La Sierra, out in California. They have something called personal and academic. It's both personal and not just personal coaching, but academic coaching, and I want to emphasize the latter as much as the former. Recent graduates of La Sierra University have come back and helped to guide students through their first year of college. They begin by reflecting on especially the first term, why they're in college. These coaches, the graduates, often are team teaching with a faculty member in a first-year seminar with a professor. and meeting with students along the way each week. So the discussions are about not only about personally succeeding in college and what college is and so on, but get into the academic domain as well. And so in the, I remember one student was interviewing, talked about how these guides or coaches provide borderline therapy, borderline advising, borderline teaching. And many of the students at La Sierra, and this is true at other places we went to, say it's the having this, what they call, sometimes called a coach, invites them to think, now why am I here? And how can I get better at being successful? And that this coaching, in turn, really propels them through college. That's just one example of many of how that kind of personal attention, not just attention, but a specific attention about the challenges that they're facing, how they can address them, including the academic challenges.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call here. We'll go to Carol in Madison next. Carol, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have something that relates to what you're talking about. I think you're talking mainly about lower income or minority students, but I have an experience which relates to that. I went back to get my master's degree in my 50s, and I wanted to take a third-year statistics course, and I hadn't had any math for about 30 years. So when I took my midterm, I couldn't answer a single question because I was totally blocked out, a mental block. And I was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and they had a program for math anxiety, and particularly women have that problem. And I took that course in math anxiety, the program in math anxiety, came back, took my final exam, got an A, and then I got a B in the course. And so I think that relates to people's not having the confidence or fear of failure.
Carol, thanks for sharing your story with us. Professor?
Yeah, I think, well, I happen to think that having been studying colleges, interviewing students for many decades now, that anxiety is one of the most formidable challenges, and this doesn't have to do with just first-generation students and so on, students of diverse backgrounds. It's the majority of students who come to college have great anxiety, and we need to find the ways to address it. And what I earlier said I think is very critical, namely that if we uplift students, we believe, and then along with that, expect them to succeed. So that doesn't mean that we just let them ride through, but that we demand of them and challenge them, but we expect them to succeed. So,
Carol, thanks again for calling and sharing your experience with us. Let's go next to Saul in Stevens Point. Saul, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I think this has come up already, but I think the shy student is a lot more important than parceling them out into different ethnic or gender groups. And that is, there are a lot of students, as you have said, come to college. They don't speak up in class. They don't say when they don't understand something. And so I think we've wasted a lot of time and effort in talking about styles of learning and so on when there's a certain shyness in especially students that are not very well prepared, and that cuts across all lines. And I think we should be spending more time talking about the shy student.
You know, I think that's a great point. I'd only add this. I'd couple it with fear. I think shyness and fear and anxiety are two of the most conspicuous qualities many students have when they enter college and often all the way through.
Well, there's a great deal of risk, a great deal more risk involved now than there has been in the past, particularly on the financial side. I was going through some old papers, and I discovered the receipts for my first year of college as an undergraduate. I went through my entire year, tuition and room and board, and the whole thing was about $1,200. Okay, well, that was 1971, and in those days, $1,200 was a lot of money. But still, I didn't have that much on the line. If I'd had to bail on the whole thing, okay, I was out the $1,200. But it wasn't like, these days, students graduate from college with debt that amounts to more than I paid for the first three houses I ever owned combined. And so there's a lot more riding on a college student's success or failure than there ever has been in the past.
Yeah, I think excuse me, debt accents the challenges that students are facing today. I don't think it's necessarily the core challenge by any mean, but certainly it hovers over many students, and we're going to only see more and more of that as states continue to cut back on public funding for higher education.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about higher education this morning. A new report came out calling it a crisis. Of course, what isn't a crisis these days? But one of the findings is that there are just as many college students dropping out of college as there are enrolling at this point. The United States lagging behind its counterparts in college graduation rates. We're talking about strategies that will help college students graduate with Cliff Conrad, Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Higher Education in the Department of Education, Leadership, and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, and also discussing it with you as well, 800-642-1234. I know that, Professor, you've learned a lot of lessons during your research. We're going to take a break when we come back. I want to make sure we get to some of those points that you want to make, and also discuss the recommendations of a report titled American Dream 2.0 they think the authors of that report think would make a difference as well. So plenty more to discuss here as we continue our talk about higher education and success in higher education and what that requires. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine today. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Why is it so tough to graduate from college in 6 years these days? We're taking a look at some of the reasons behind that and where success is being found. Trying to emphasize the positive here. There are just as many college students dropping out as there are enrolling. Why is that? Well, we've been discussing that this hour and talking about ways to make a difference. 800-642-1234, talk at WPR and Facebook, all three good ways to connect with the program. Professor Conrad, the report American Dream 2.0 makes three recommendations that they think would help. And I'd like to have you respond to these quickly and then talk about what your research has uncovered as you've been taking a look at this issue. One, make financial aid simple and transparent. Well, having filled out a lot of FAFSA forms in my lifetime, I would say hear, hear to that. Embrace innovations that serve all students and urge institutions, states, and students to share responsibility for producing more graduates without compromising access or affordability. What do you think?
Yeah, could you repeat the third one again? I'm not sure.
Okay, the third one, and this one's a little squishy, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Urge institutions, states, and students to share responsibility for producing more graduates without compromising access or affordability.
Yeah, I mean, these are at a very, very high level of abstraction, and I basically agree with all three of them. Mm-hmm. Let me use the third one as a segue into what I was going to say about some lessons we can learn from other institutions and dig deeper. I think sometimes we just want the magic bullet, right? And one or two or three little things. But I think we often forget what's really important and haven't learned what's really important. Let's take shared responsibility. In our three-year study, minority-serving colleges and universities, and I've been to about 800 other colleges and universities around the world, by the way, is a very simple idea. And that is, instead of celebrating individualism, that education is all about me and all about individual achievement, we should also place as much emphasis on collaboration. They use the term shared responsibility, but let me elaborate on collaboration very briefly. Collaboration, as we've come to appreciate, means learning with and from others and in turn giving back. That's a pretty radical idea in a nation and much of the rest of the world that celebrates individual achievement in the higher learning. We have, in studying these various minority-serving institutions, we have come across an ethos and an ethic in which everybody is engaged in learning with and from others, and in turn giving back to the world in which they are entering. And that is the greatest motivator. And people learn enormously from one another. Take an example, peer-led team learning program, Morehouse College. Many of your people listening in may know about Morehouse down at Atlanta College, all-male, historically black colleges. To see young men engaged in teaching and learning with one another. It begins like led by a peer, somebody who's a junior or sophomore, junior, helping freshmen, and all of a sudden the lines get blurred. That kind of giving and taking, where everyone is involved in teaching and learning, partly echoing what I said earlier, what I said about blurring roles, where everybody is working together. And to observe that, as we did, has been quite remarkable. And I think the strongest statement I can make is, as I've come back to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I've begun to appreciate how we ought to be doing much more with our students, and I try to do this in my own teaching, to engage them in collaboration. That's just one overarching lesson, that it's not just about me, it's about we or us. And if there's one lesson I think that I've learned that has made a difference, and I think can make a huge difference, it's that one. And I could go on to talk some other ones as well that I think are important.
Well, I want to make sure we get to that, but we've got full phone banks here, and I'd like to give our listeners a chance to have their say. Jerry in Bark River, Michigan. Chilly up in the UP this morning?
Yes, very cold.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm a professor at a Bay College. It's a community college, and one of the things that I see, I wholeheartedly agree with your guest. The students are coming in from all different aspects. We get a wide variety of students, but some of these students are coming from broken homes and whatever. But they also are working 2 to 3 jobs, many of them, and trying to get an education. They don't have time. So what I really work on is organization, getting them structured. Organized so that they can succeed. And the other thing is, which I really agree with, as your guest says, is to get the attitude that they can succeed. And every day when I go in, I put on the top of the board, I can do it. And I keep re-emphasizing that. And I really appreciate this topic. So.
Jerry, thanks a lot for sharing that. The teacher and the relationship with the student is so critical, isn't it?
Absolutely. I can't. Jerry just made my day. I appreciate his comment very, very much. And I think the role that faculty have in working with that student that way and uplifting, and including introducing them to those kind of basic college-going skills that Jerry is partly alluding to, of what is college and how can I help? And if you got this challenge, what are some ways that we can work it out and so on? So mm-hmm. I appreciate his point very much.
Yeah, Jerry, thanks so much for the call. But what about, we've got so much of how professors are evaluated is based on research and publication. How much of an evaluation of a professor's work at a major university, let's say, is based on how they perform in the classroom and their ability to teach?
Well, I think I've been involved in that for many, many years, and including studying that. I think that we place even less emphasis today than we did a decade ago or 2 decades ago. And we often talk about it at major research universities as being important, but I've seen far too many instances, including reviewing people coming up for tenure and promotion to full professor, where their teaching evaluations are marginalized, relatively speaking. So mm-hmm. I'm afraid that we've not made any progress in addressing that challenge in the last few years, and we put it on the margins far too often.
Let's try and get one more call in here, or maybe even two. Bill in Eau Claire, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing today?
Great.
One of the things, concerns I've seen is, I've had a person who was going to school talking to me and was complaining about his tuition fees, $40,000. I said, well, what are you studying? He's going to school to be a veterinary technician. Is it smart to spend $40,000 on a $10 an hour job? I mean, how long is it going to take him to be able to pay that back?
Bill, thanks for that. Professor, we're having students make poor choices in terms of their careers and what they spend to get them.
That's why we need some good coaching on the front end and advising, including from faculty. And other students like the coach I mentioned at La Sierra University. Let's be transparent about these kind of things on the front end, mm-hmm. not on the back end.
Bill, thanks so much for that. There are so many variables here, and every student who comes into college has had a different background and so forth, and yet we kind of lump them all together, and they're the student body.
We do.
There are a lot of students coming to school who have been the center of their parents' world. The so-called helicopter parents. It's not hard to pick them out if you're teaching, I don't think. How much is the sense of entitlement that so many students are coming into college with a factor? I mean, it's a pretty big culture shock for them sometimes, I think, to find out that they really aren't the center of the universe.
Yeah, I'm familiar with many of those students, and quite frankly, a number of members of my family have been relatively entitled, even though I grew up in North Dakota. I think some of those students can have... experiences that create some what Fessinger called cognitive dissonance when they get to college and can be a little trouble. I think what more happens, excuse me, more often than not, is students who are entitled to go to certain schools, Amherst, Williams, Stanford, and so on, often get coddled on their way through college. And and so they have much less anxiety than they should have.
Yeah, I wonder how that works out for them when they get out in the so-called real world.
Yeah,
you said earlier you'd found a couple of other things in your research you wanted to share. We probably have time for one of those. Go ahead and share that.
Let me give a quick example. I think sometimes we don't make education relevant to the lives of students, far too often, and this has been indirectly alluded to so far. One of the great lessons that Mary Beth Gassman and I have come to appreciate is culturally relevant learning experiences, where students are engaged in solving real-world problems. And a good example is indigenous problem solving at Salish Kootenai College up in Montana, where you get students out looking at real-world problems, interviewing a young sophomore student at that college, SKC, and she got involved and was concerned about mercury in the water, in the lake, got involved with a professor, a STEM professor, and the two of them did research together, ultimately published the work in Nature magazine, a highly regarded publication, and in turn, she's now on studying at the medical school at the University of Washington, a great example of uplifting people. And so instead of saying people aren't prepared for college, let's give them the kind of opportunities that can enrich and enlarge them and raise them up rather than knock them down.
Remind us again, Professor, you've got a book coming out shortly. What was that again?
The book is called Lessons from the Margins, : What American Higher Education Can Learn from Minority-Serving Colleges. And it's with Clifton Conrad and Mary Beth Gassman, my colleague at the University of Pennsylvania.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there, Professor. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you very much, John.
Cliff Conrad is Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Higher Education in the Department of Education, Leadership, and Policy Analysis at the UW-Madison. This program was produced by Robin Cherry, who also handled on-air production this morning. Cynthia Schuster was the director for this hour on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.